Chapter 2. The path back down to the dig was rough and rocky, but if he was right about what he'd seen moving toward the island, there was no time to take it slowly. Miller sprinted, stumbling several times but catching his balance and running on. Halfway down, he risked a shout. "Cook!" he called. "Cook!" But there was no answer. Miller cursed and kept running. Every second might make all the difference. "Cook!" he called again as he finally came in sight of the spot they had excavated. Still no answer. Cook was nowhere in sight. Miller ran to the pit they'd scratched out in the shadow of one of the great stone heads. He was about to call out again, but froze as he stood on the edge of the pit. Cook lay curled in the bottom of the hole, some 8 feet down. Around him lay piles of carefully tagged bones, the skeletal remains of some hundreds of islanders. The spots where they had been discovered were carefully marked in the grid Cook and Miller laid out in the bottom of the excavation. Cook was lying across the grid, from H-17 to L-29. His coffee cup was beside him, smashed into shards. Several hand tools were scattered around him, and the seismograph was tipped over a few feet from his head. His face, half turned to the side, looked completely lifeless, and Miller was sure he was dead. He had stumbled, fallen into the pit, and hit his head. It was obvious. But even as Miller stared, stunned, Cook twitched. His face muscles jerked violently, his left leg kicked, and his hands opened and closed. Cook was alive, and they were 6 hard hours by air from the hospital in Tahiti. In a way, Miller thought, death would have been easier to handle. Since Cook was alive, the choices confronting him were worse. If Cook had a head or neck injury, moving him would be a slow, delicate operation. Any sudden movement could cause permanent damage to brain, nerves, or spinal cord. But Miller knew he had no time for delicacy, and if he didn't move fast, they were both dead. Miller jumped down into the pit and knelt beside Cook. He picked up his partner's wrist. The pulse was fast, but steady and strong. Miller swore. He was wasting time. It didn't matter what Cook's pulse was doing. It could be keeping tango time for all the difference it made. If Cook was alive, there was still only one course of action, and it had to be done fast. Miller bent to pick up his partner and paused. He heard a small, chittering noise, just barely audible. At first, he thought it must be Cook's teeth, and the thought of a seizure scared him. He had no time to deal with it, and had no real idea of what to do. He turned Cook's chin with his fingertips. No movement. Cook's jaw was locked tight, his teeth clamped. Miller could even see the jaw muscles standing out rigidly. But the chittering continued. Half turning, Miller looked around him in the darkness of the pit. Spotting the seismograph a few feet away, tipped onto its side, he reached over and set it upright. The needle was scrabbling across the page, and the chittering sound came each time the tip hit the edge of the chart, which it did with nearly every stroke. Normally, the needle stayed right in the middle, scratching its small peaks and valleys under the paper in a steady rhythm. It would take a geologic event of the first magnitude to make the needle hit the edge, an event so cataclysmic, only a few such had ever been recorded. Something like that was what was racing towards them right now. "Oh, shit," Miller breathed. He quickly turned back to Cook's still body, grabbed it and lifted, throwing the unconscious man over the shoulder. The time for worrying and pondering choices was long past. Now he had to sprint for the plane and hope he made it. Stumbling up to his feet, Miller adjusted the load. Thank God Cook was a small man, but this was still not going to be easy. He hurried up the narrow ramp and out of the pit, hitting a running stride with his first few steps. As fast as he could go under the weight of his partner's twitching body, he ran down the path that led to the beach. It was less than half a mile, a distance Miller could normally make in under 3 minutes. But with the added weight of Cook, and with the pressure of knowing that every second counted, it seemed to take forever. Miller stagger-sprinted past the camp where he and Cook had lived for nearly 3 months. The breakfast coffee pot still sat on the flat rock beside the fire, and Miller's laundry hung from the makeshift clothesline behind the tent. But there was no time to stop, not even for passports, money, Christ, the research, the hundreds of pages of notes, observations, charts, the dozens of computer disks. It would all be lost. All the thousands of hours of backbreaking, mind-numbing, skinned-knuckle labor that had gone into this project. All gone. In his mind, Miller was howling at the agony of his work's coming destruction. But he didn't slow down. Didn't break his stride, even for a second. He didn't dare to. The beach was in sight now. Miller kicked in the afterburner, sprinting now with everything he had. His rented seaplane was pulled up on the beach, and gasping and panting for air, he got the door opened and flung Cook into the passenger seat. Then he jumped into the pilot's seat and started the engine. As it warmed up, he belted Cook in, then ran back to unmoor the plane. As he jumped back in and belted himself in with one hand, he checked the instruments. The engine was still cold, but it would do. It would have to do. Miller moved the throttle forward. The engine hesitated, then roared. The plane shook more than usual. The engine was running very rough. It needed more warm-up time, time he did not have. At least the fuel tanks were topped off, and he had kept up on the routine maintenance. Great. The little plane lurched down the beach and into the water. The takeoff from the lagoon would be tricky, not that he had any choice. It would be difficult to judge the wind, the waves, and the tide would be moving in opposite directions. Add to that a cold engine and full fuel tanks, and he knew he'd need more than a little luck. Miller pushed the engine up to its top speed and headed out. The sea was an unnatural green, glassy calm as he came out around the headland. The surface of the water seemed slick and greasy, and he could not remember ever seeing anything like it before. Still, this was no time to question the small breaks. Takeoff would be considerably easier on a calm sea. Miller throttled back and drifted for a moment, just long enough to gauge the wind. The plane's nose swung slightly. He turned to compensate, heading directly into the stiff breeze and swearing under his breath when he saw where he was headed. Great, he thought. Directly toward the wave. And as he looked down the nose of the plane to the horizon, Miller saw it. The great wave. Tsunami. It stretched from horizon to horizon, and it was taller than the spire of the Berkeley Chapel, taller than the UC Stadium, taller than a 15-story building! And it was close. Noticeably closer all the time. It moved with the speed of a Japanese bullet train, and it was headed right at him. This was going to be a very near thing. The wind was at least 20 knots, which would help if he could get up to speed before the wave swept him under. And if not, well, at least it would be all over very quickly. Miller pulled the throttle all the way back. It revved into the red, but that didn't matter. If he didn't make it over the wave, engine wear wasn't going to count for too much. The engine coughed once, and Miller's heart lurched up into his throat. Then the engine steadied, smoothed out, and roared with all the power it had. The whole plane shook. Miller's hands were vibrating like mad as he pushed the plane to its limit and beyond. The wave was bearing down on him now, close enough to hit with a well-thrown baseball. His speed, he knew, was not quite enough. Not yet.
Come on, you bastard!
He snarled at the little plane, subconsciously pulling the throttle back still farther, even though it was already hard against its extreme limit. The wave was close enough to hit with a basketball now. Miller hauled back on the stick, no lift yet, but the plane trembled slightly, wig-wagging from side to side. And now the wave was so close that he could have hit it with a bowling ball. And still, the little plane picked up speed without showing any further sign of lifting off. Miller leveled the stick, then once more pulled it back with all his concentration and willpower. Slowly, too slowly, the plane twitched, skipped, and the nose began to lift. And as the enormous, all-powerful tsunami crashed through the space where he'd been just seconds ago, Miller lifted the nose, banked back toward the island, and grabbed for altitude. It seemed that the wave would snatch at one of the pontoons, dragging them down into that tumbling hell of unimaginable power. But somehow Miller rose above it. Then, above the wave, he was rising to a comfortable 500 feet and flying over the island. As Miller watched, the wave crashed into the stone heads and they disappeared. They did not teeter or topple or crash over. They were simply gone, swept away by the unbelievable power and fury of the tsunami. So was the camp, the excavation, literally everything on the island, and the island itself, Runapuake, all gone. Miller took a ragged breath and blew it out again. That had almost been him down there, a small chip of flotsam smashed under by a wall of water the size of Manhattan. If he had not seen the wave coming, had not had time, just barely, to get away. He shuddered. It didn't do to think about it. After all, he had gotten away. But what a remarkable string of coincidences it was that had allowed him to escape. The scientist in him usually reacted suspiciously to such lucky chance, but this time he'd take it. Whether it had been the hand of God, the hammer of Thor, or just a lucky roll of the dice, he'd take it. Miller turned the plane again and checked his instruments. After some quick figuring, he set his course. He could make it to Tahiti. It was the closest spot with a major hospital, which he would need if Cook was to have a chance. He gave a last check to the controls and glanced at Cook. To his astonishment, Cook's eyes were open. He was staring straight ahead, focusing on nothing.
Jesus,
Miller said.
I thought you were dead. How do you feel?
Cook coughed twice, as if trying to clear his throat, and did not respond. In fact, he didn't even blink. Miller looked back at the controls. He's still unconscious, he thought. But then Cook coughed again, three times, and Miller glanced back at him.
Cook!
He started, but could think of nothing more to say. Because what was happening to his partner was totally beyond anything he had ever seen or heard of before. Cook had begun to twitch. His face muscles were jumping, as if each muscle was independent of all the others. Almost as if some crazy machine was testing them, one at a time. And then Cook's face began to flow? And there was no other way to describe it. Cook's face went through a bewildering range of expressions at a speed that seemed impossible, leaving the impression of a face made of silly putty, melting rapidly through a series of mutations. It was like watching somebody channel surf through dozens of TV stations. Miller felt his jaw hang open as he watched his partner's face rocket through its changes. The sight was so astonishing, so unnerving, that for a moment, Miller forgot where he was. He was brought back to the present when the little plane went into a shallow dive. He quickly put his attention back on the controls and leveled off again. He glanced back at Cook. The twitching had stopped. The face was Cook now, no question. Miller let out his breath to ask Cook how he felt. Then Cook screamed.
Tony! Oh, Jesus God, Tony!
He said, then made a choking sound, and his face flickered once, twice, three times. A new expression settled into place, an expression of cheerful craftiness. It was Cook, yes, but it was also, ever so subtly, not Cook. Not at all.
Ah, said the voice. You are Tony. Yes.
The voice, too, was Cook but not Cook. Suddenly changed. The sound of it made goose flesh rise on Miller's back. Miller could only gape at him for a long moment.
Tony!
Cook repeated, as if prompting him to speak.
What the... Cook, what the hell ha... Are you all right?
A-okay,
Cook said.
All systems functioning within normal parameters.
Just stay calm. Keep that belt fastened,
Miller told him.
You hit your head, Jay, but we'll be at a hospital in a few hours, so just relax. Nothing to worry about.
No,
No, Cook replied with a ghastly smile. Null set worries, Tony.
Jesus fuck, Miller muttered. Please, Cook, try to rest, huh?
Cook frowned.
Reading,
he said, and again he stared straight ahead without focus.
Access, stand by.
His mouth opened, and then his face shifted again, and he screamed.
Ah, shit! Oh, God almighty! They'll kill us all!
He shrieked.
Sweet suffering Jesus! Tony, my God, they won't stop until we're all dead! You have to!
Cook's body lurched against the seatbelt as if zapped by an electrical current. He twitched, his face flickered again, and settled back into the screaming Cook.
Ah!
Cook, take it easy. You hit your head.
No, no, God damn it. Tony, please listen. I can't.
Cook's body bucked again and he gasped hoarsely with pain.
War,
he panted.
It's war, and you're a part of it now.
Cook,
Miller began.
What the fuck are you?
But once again, the violent spasms shook him, and this time his face settled into the calm, patient mask of the crafty Cook.
Perhaps I overstate,
Cook said.
Real-time hunger. Food is where...
And Miller could only stare. End of chapter.